say they have been deprived of adequate health care, among other issues. A number of hunger-striking detainees have lost consciousness as the strike drags on. The Al-Wafaq National Islamic Society has called on people to answer the prisoners' call for a sit-in in support of them on Friday. During the past decade, Bahrain has been ratcheting up a crackdown on the country's Shia majority that only demands more political freedom. Massive street protests first started in 2011, but were suppressed with the help of Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. A Palestinian man has succumbed to injuries he sustained during an Israeli raid on the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound more than 2 years ago. 30-year-old Hamza Abu Sinaina was hit with rubber bullets fired by regime forces while performing prayers in May 2021. He sustained multiple skull fractures and lost his left eye. According to medical sources, he had been suffering from the effects of his injuries for the past months, and his health worsened a few weeks before his death. The new fatality came as Israel is escalating its bloody repression against Palestinians. More than 200 Palestinians have been killed across the occupied territories since the beginning of this year. In Turkey, a stark division has emerged among those who express unwavering trust in the government's economic strategies and those who remain skeptical, seeing no signs of a positive outcome. That as the Turkish president has vowed to ease the cost of living burden on the people as soon as possible. Press TV's correspondent in Istanbul reports.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has vowed to address the pressing cost of living crisis plaguing the nation. Attributing the situation to the global economic downturn, Erdogan has assured that his government will swiftly resolve this issue while upholding his promises to the people impacted by the devastating February earthquake. He had previously pledged to complete the reconstruction efforts within a year.
We vow to tackle the escalating cost of living caused by global crisis. We are aware that the cost of living has been suffocating our nation recently. As we have solved every problem of our country, I hope we will solve this problem again. We will not neglect anyone's right and will not leave anyone's expectations unanswered.
Analysts argue that this whole economic crisis is the result of wrong economic strategies and decisions made by the same ruling government for the past years, and they cannot fix what they have done now.
The people who created the problem and don't see it as a problem are very unlikely to fix it. For this reason, it's naive to expect from the creator of the problem to solve the problem. I don't know on what basis the president is making these promises. He spoke about the cost of living, which has been getting higher for the past 2 years. Every month, we have a new raises in prices from foodstuff to rents and fuel. When the new government came and Mehmet Şimşek was appointed, we waited for something positive to happen. But the lira value against US dollar is dropping, and we are not seeing any new investments in the country. So where are all the new policies they want implement?
A few weeks ago, the vice president said that a new economic plan is to be revealed in September that will have a positive impact on the life of citizens, production and market, saying this plan will increase investments in the country.
Turkey, after the pandemic, was facing a few economic issues, just like other countries in the world, struggling to encounter post-lockdown repercussions, and then came the devastating earthquake, and then elections. So, what we are facing from inflation to change in lira value is normal to what country has been going through. However, I think the government's plan will ease the economic crisis. But it will take time, of course. When speaking about the economy, nothing can happen in one night.
This is while inflation is gaining a new momentum. The annual inflation went up from 38.2% to 47.8% in a single month in July. Lack of economic investments, inflation, low Turkish lira value against the US dollar, and high cost of living. This is how the Turkish economy is going nowadays, with some blaming the pandemic and earthquake, while others say it is the government's wrong economic decisions. Amid the government promises and opposition criticism regarding Erdogan's extended tenure, there remains uncertainty regarding the potential success of the newly appointed economic team in swiftly executing their plans.
It's not that bad. Yes, the Turkish lira value has dropped and the cost of living has risen, but the government also raised the minimum wage and is trying to solve the economic problems which occurred due to the earthquake.
The ruling party must act fast to solve this economic crisis ahead of an upcoming critical local election, which will determine the fate of Istanbul, Ankara and other major cities. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Elsewhere, Tehran reiterates its readiness to cooperate with Riyadh in a wide array of issues, including regional security. Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian said both countries agree that previous deals regarding security, commerce and economy must be implemented. Amir Abdullahian was speaking at a joint press conference with his Saudi counterpart. Prince Faisal bin Farhan said Riyadh is looking forward to further strengthening relations on the basis of mutual respect. The Saudi foreign minister said Riyadh was willing to ensure lasting security in the region through cooperation with Tehran. He said King Salman has officially invited Iran's president to Riyadh. Prince Faisal made a visit to the Islamic Republic in June, just weeks after Tehran and Riyadh agreed to resume diplomatic relations. The two countries had severed ties in 2016 following angry protests in Iran over the execution of the Shiite Nimr al-Nimr in the kingdom. Iran and Saudi Arabia have pledged to work for enhanced regional stability. Political analyst Fuad Izadi says only time will tell whether Saudi Arabia can withstand pressure from the US and Israel and maintain good relations with Iran.
I think the Saudi government has realized that confronting Iran is not in line with their national interest, and it's really not possible to fight Iran in that manner any longer. And Iran historically has been interested in resolving issues with Saudi Arabia. Iran and Saudi Arabia are neighbors. Neighbors should not be confronting each other. I think as time progresses, you will see these type of exchanges, but with the visit of Iran's president, the ties will improve. There is a question that needs to be answered, and that is whether the Saudis can withstand pressures from the United States and Israel to continue this policy of following their own interests instead of listening to the ill-advised rhetoric of the United States and Israel. Whether they can do that or not, time will tell, but I think so far so good.
And earlier, our correspondent Gisu Mish Ahmadi shed more light on the details of the Iranian foreign minister's visit to Saudi Arabia.
And if you want to read between the lines, there are many key issues and important messages being sent out to the world, including the fact that both countries say that they are prepared to cooperate together on regional security. And this is something that we do know is high on the agenda of the Raisi administration. He has been extending his hand to neighboring countries, and he has been promoting regional security being dealt with by regional countries rather than foreign elements. And he has been able to actually gain a lot of support by neighboring countries on this foreign policy issue that he's been trying to advocate over the past 2 years. And now we see Saudi Arabia, a key player in the region, also jumping on the bandwagon. So this is a very important. And then again, Kaveh, there are basically two issues I think any pundit would be looking at in respect to finding out whether two countries have good relations. Are we looking at ties growing and expanding? And one is trade, the second is sports, and the fact that the press conference was wrapped up by the foreign ministers saying that they will be holding friendly football matches.
Iran has organized a conference in Tehran to review the effects of sanctions on the access of patients to life-saving medicines. Iranian officials have contradicted U.S. claims, asserting that medical supplies and food items have not been exempted from the sanctions in practice. Saman Kajuri has the details.
Tehran has hosted a conference to discuss the effects of sanctions on the health of patients. Speaking at the event, Secretary of the Strategic Council of Foreign Relations Abbas Araghchi rejected the U.S. claims that medicine and food items are exempted from sanctions.
There might be such a thing on the surface, but in practice, the actions taken by the U.S. administration have imposed a strong sanction in this area. The U.S. sanctions against Iran cover a very wide network, and in addition to the humanitarian exceptions that they have apparently placed in the field of medicine, there are very detailed conditions by the Office of Foreign Assets Control of the U.S. Treasury Department in a way that makes their implementation practically impossible for pharmaceutical companies.
Many human rights groups have criticized the U.S. for cutting off banking ties with Iran through threatening the international banks with punitive fines by the U.S. Department of Treasury, which has led to a disruption in the accessibility of vital medical supplies for Iranian patients.
The most important report in this matter was submitted to the UN Human Rights Council last year by Mrs. Duhan, the special rapporteur on unilateral coercive measures of the United Nations. The U.S. and the West, self-proclaimed advocates of human rights, were against this report and even voted against the resolution to extend her mission. Even during her report presentation in September last year, they chose not to be present in the meeting hall. Self-criticism is not within their tolerance.
Although the U.S. claims that the sanctions do not directly ban the sales of medicines to Iran, they block every financial route needed to obtain drugs for patients suffering from diseases such as diabetes, kidney failure, hemophilia, multiple sclerosis, thalassemia, and leukemia.
Iranian officials have repeatedly condemned the sanctions against the Iranian nation as a crime against humanity, saying such unilateral restrictive measures have put the lives of vulnerable people at risk by hampering their access to medicine. Saman Kujurib, Tehran.
Turning elsewhere, the United States has approved the transfer of F-16 fighter jets to Ukraine from Denmark and the Netherlands. A U.S. official said Washington has assured both countries that it will expedite the approval of transfer requests for F-16s after Ukrainian pilots are trained. The transfer of F-16s from U.S. allies to Ukraine needs Washington's approval. A coalition of 11 countries is due to start training Ukrainian pilots to fly the fighter jets this month in Denmark. U.S. officials have privately said that the F-16 fighter jets would be no game changer when they arrive, given Russia's air defense systems and its air superiority. The International Military Technical Forum, Army 2023, is taking place in the Moscow region until the 20th of August. This year's Army Expo is the 9th edition of the show, which showcases new products in the military industry and includes equipment demonstrations from over 70 countries.
Around 800 delegates from 76 countries have arrived at the International Military Technical Forum held in Moscow region. Their presence showed a desire to strengthen and develop mutually beneficial cooperation with Russia, despite the West's anti-Russian sanctions. Addressing the participants, President Vladimir Putin noted that the U.S., along with NATO members, use all military and non-military means to pressure nations into submitting to their will, adding that all this is taking place amid a disintegrating arms control framework.
In particular, the United States intent on reformatting the existing system of interstate relations in the Asia-Pacific region as it deems fit. In fact, efforts to promote these so-called Indo-Pacific strategies are aimed at creating U.S.-led military and political associations. We cannot exclude that these efforts may pave the way to fully integrate NATO forces with the AUKUS structures as they take shape.
Putin stated Ukraine as a case which demonstrates where the Western policy of pouring fuel on fire leads.
By pumping billions of dollars into the neo-Nazi regime and supplying it with equipment, arms and munitions, sending military advisors and mercenaries there, they are doing everything to further escalate the conflict and draw other countries into it.
According to the Russian Defense Minister, Ukraine's military resource is almost exhausted, and a special military operation has shown that there is nothing invulnerable to Russian weapons on the battlefield today.
No one should have any illusions that against the backdrop of a special military operation, Russian interests can be harmed. I wanted to draw attention to the fact that we also have cluster munitions in service. Until now, for humanitarian reasons, we have refrained from using them. However, this decision may be reconsidered.
This year, the forum is widely represented by weapons and military equipment that have already proven efficient in action. According to the Russian Defense Minister, the Russian army is expected to sign contracts worth over $4.7 billion at the forum. Iran has also presented a whole range of new combat drones.
Russia has expressed its determination to deepen technological partnerships and military technical cooperation with other countries and also continue taking advantage of the already established cooperation ties. The Army Expo's success is a clear indication that the West has lost most of its power in forcing countries to bend to its will. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
And that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour, but don't go away.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Yazid unmasked in his true heathen colors. In the name of God, Salam and welcome to the program. The first of the month of Safar refreshes memories of the immortal saga of the noble captives of the heart-rending tragedy of Karbala, who, despite being in chains and fetters, made Islam and all humanitarian values triumph in the court of the tyrant Yazid, thus bequeathing to posterity faith in divine promise of the eventual victory of truth over falsehood, irrespective of the intensity of the plots and crimes of the oppressors. Please stay with us for a special feature in this regard. Today, 20 days after the epic of Ashura, that is, the heart-rending martyrdom of Imam Hussein, his sons, nephews, brothers, and companions, on the 10th of Muharram, the children and womenfolk of the Prophet's blessed household were brought to Damascus, along with the severed heads of the martyrs of Karbala. The only grown-up man amongst the noble captives was the 23-year-old Imam Zainul Abidin, peace upon him, the son and successor of Imam Hussein, peace upon him, who, despite his sick health, was clasped in chains and fetters by the Umayyad forces, along with his wife, his 4-year-old son, Imam Baqir, peace upon him, his sisters, his aunt, Hazrat Zainab, peace upon her, the indomitable daughter of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Before entering the city, the captives were made to stop for 3 days at Bab al-Tuma Gate until the streets were decorated and then paraded in front of the ignorant people of Damascus, who were exulting in joy, unaware of the identity of the noble captives. What a pathetic sight it was. Even in such a sorrowful state, the household of the Prophet carried themselves in dignity. They were pictures of patience, despite the gruesome sight of the heads of martyrs mounted on lances, and the noble ladies and children tied in a rope. This was their unique jihad. It was a jihad to make Islam triumph in the court of the cowardly enemy. When the noble captives entered the palace, they were shocked to see Yazid sitting on a gilded throne with a goblet of wine in his hand, while in front of him lay the head of Imam Hussein, peace upon him, in a tray. He had a cane in his other hand and was showing disrespect to the severed head. The tyrant was elated at the martyrdom of Imam Hussein, peace upon him. He openly wished that if only his infidel ancestors, who in trying to attack the Prophet had been slain in the battles of Badr and Uhud, were alive this day to witness how he had humiliated the Prophet's household. He went on to recite a couplet as further proof of his lack of faith in Islam by saying, "The Hashemites played the game of kingdom. Neither any message descended from heaven, nor revelation." At this blasphemy, Hazrat Zainab, peace upon her, could no longer bear the sight of the accursed Yazid disrespecting the severed head of Imam Hussein, peace upon him. As her grief-stricken younger sister, Umm Kulthum, flung herself on the severed head of her brother, Hazrat Zainab started one of her most eloquent sermons that had a profound effect on the gathering. She said, "All praise belongs to God, the sustainer and preserver of the universe, and may his blessings be showered on my grandfather, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. The Holy Quran says in Ayah 10 of Surah Rum, "Then evil was the end of those who wrought evil, for they belied the signs of God and mocked at them." The Prophet's granddaughter further said, "O Yazid, you think that you have made our life miserable, an existence unbearable, and you have made us prisoners? And because we have been presented in your court, you feel elated? You think that we have been disrespected and dishonored by God, and that you have been honored and elevated to this position by him? This apparent success of yours is the result of your worldly might, and this makes you puffed with pride at our disaster. You feel that you have conquered the whole world, and you feel that you are well set in power and control. Only time will teach you a bitter lesson." Ayah 177 of Surah Ali Imran points out to people like you who are destined to go to hell when God says, "Let not those who disbelieve think that our giving them respite is good for themselves. We only give them respite so that they may increase in sins, and for them is a disgraceful chastisement." Continued in her sermon, that made the whole court realize the grave sin Yazid had committed. She said, "Oh, you, the son of freed slaves, is this your justice that the ladies of your household remain veiled, and we, the Prophet's family, should be paraded thus? You have insulted our dignity. Our faces have been unveiled. Your villainous soldiers have exposed us to public view. And all along, the journey people have looked at us. We do not have our male companions anymore to come to our rescue. Oh, Yazid, your misdeeds have clearly proved your rebellion towards God and the message the Holy Prophet brought to this world. And this has proved beyond doubt that you refuse to honor the prophetic message sent by God. This behavior of yours does not come as a surprise, for your ancestors chewed the liver of the Prophet's uncle, Hamza ibn Abdul Muttalib, and the wife of Abu Sufyan, mutilated his body, had his liver taken out, sucked it, and quenched her thirst for vengeance at the Battle of Uhud. You belong to this clan, which always opposed the Prophet and collected armies from various clans to oppose him. The descendants of such rabble and monsters are the enemies of God and his Prophet, and are expected to be merciless and deadly, since violence is part of their nature." When it was the turn of Imam Zainul Abidin, peace upon him, to speak, he delivered an electrifying sermon on the God-given merits of the Ahlul Bayt that stunned the filthy tyrant. As the people of Syria shocked at the unpardonable crime their ruler had committed, started weeping. Yazid ordered the muazzin, or caller to prayer, to recite the azan, although it was not yet time for the ritual prayer, nor was the place ritually clean to hold the prayer. When the muazzin said, Allahu Akbar, Imam Zainul Abidin, peace upon him, said, You have acknowledged as great the greatest one who cannot be measured and cannot be perceived by senses. There is nothing greater than Allah. When the muazzin recited, Ashhadu an la ilaha illallah, which means, I testify there is no God except Allah, the Imam said, My hair, my skin, my flesh, my blood, my brain, and my bones bear witness that there is no God but Allah. When the muazzin chanted, Ashhadu anna Muhammadan Rasulullah, which means, I testify that Muhammad is the messenger of Allah, the Imam turned to Yazid and asked him, O Yazid, is Muhammad your grandfather or mine? If you say that he's yours, then you are a liar. And if you admit that he's mine, then why did you kill his grandson and family? Yazid was visibly shaken and stormed out of the court in anger, while the people of Syria, on realizing the identity of the noble captives, started protesting at the unpardonable crimes the Umayyad regime had committed. Thus, with their bold sermons, even in captivity, the noble aunt and nephew ripped off the mask of hypocrisy from the face of the ungodly Umayyad regime and exposed Yazid in his true heathen colors.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Russia says that Kiev's counteroffensive has not gained much, while Ukraine is boasting of what it calls taking the war to Russia. More and more drone attacks are being conducted on the Russian capital, as well as targets in the Black Sea recently. Now, Russia, of course, saying it's shot down most of the drones and missiles. Now, most recent attacks focusing on Russian-controlled Donbas region and on the other side, Ukrainian facilities in Kharkiv and Zaporizhia. Stay with us for a discussion of the Ukraine-Russia war in this episode of The Spotlight. Let me introduce our guests. John Bosnich, journalist, activist, and political analyst, is joining me from Belgrade. Also with us today is Scott Bennett, who's a political commentator out of San Francisco. Okay, beginning with John Bosnich, you know, Kiev is claiming that its drones have put a Russian Black Sea fleet vessel out of action in such a way it's no more able to perform combat missions. You know, on Thursday night, at least 10 attacks using drone boats were reportedly conducted in the Black Sea, and they targeted Russian military ships. I want to ask you, how significant do you think this could be?
Well, every stage of the elevation of the level of the conflict is, of course, going to create new challenges. But we know, from past experience until this stage that Russia has been able to respond more quickly on the field and in the air and on the water than Ukraine, because Russia is producing its own equipment, Russia is producing its own responses, and Russia is dominating the drone war already.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Scott, the Ukrainian Navy, some people say that because the Navy is not powerful enough to challenge the Russian military, still their drones are relatively cheap, they're accessible and effective, and they could provide a relatively fast and low-profile threat to Russian military ships, particularly when such attacks happen overnight. Now, could the use of drones prove to be a game-changer in the war?
No, not at all. They're more like annoying flies that may cause irritating bites, but when you find the nest and destroy it, you destroy the flies. And I think Russia is adapting its countermeasures to do exactly that. So they have been annoyed by drones slamming into financial districts in Moscow. They have been annoyed by cluster bombs being shelled on civilian areas and sea drones, you know, ramming into ships. But Russia's been prepared for that. And as your previous guest said, they have been producing far superior weaponry in far superior numbers, superior tanks, hypersonic missiles, a morally inspired military, full spectrum dominance on the information field, on the surveillance field, on the satellite field. Mm-hmm. They have far superior weapons, and they've been fighting this in a defensive way in order to win the diplomatic soft power of the majority of the world's nations. So there's a kinetic aspect, which you see the Ukrainian army dropping from 500,000 to 43,000 men, many of whom don't want to serve. Many of them are defecting because they've seen so many soldiers in Ukraine having their organs cut out for the black market organ harvesting that the U.S. has also been doing. There's also the moral component of the biochemical labs, which the United States had in Ukraine. So the kinetic factors, the moral factors, the international diplomatic soft power war is all going towards Russia's column. And the overall support of the world, I think, is on Russia's side and not with Ukraine or America, because we're witnessing the hypocrisy and the underlining evil that has animated this U.S.-Ukraine proxy war, okay, which has been nothing but genocide.
All right, now, John, let's take a look at another aspect of this war. Russian officials saying that Ukraine has hit the Donetsk University building using cluster shells, and that has caused widespread damage. And Kiev had promised, when receiving this aid, not to use this Western-provided cluster munitions inside Russian soil and against civilians. So why doesn't the U.S. make an objection to Kiev that's using these weapons that are banned by more than 120 countries?
I hope you're joking, because the United States doesn't care what the world thinks at all. The United States is using the conflict in Ukraine to set brother against brother. This is the old role that the English used to play around the world. Gandhi once said that if you want to know where the British have been, where the English have been in particular, you can go far, far out of the city into the forest and find a little stream, and if you find two brother fish at each other's throats, you know the English have been there. And that's what the Americans have inherited from England, their colonial founders, and that's what they're doing now. And they're trying to make a war between the Ukrainian people and the Russian people that will make them hate each other forever. And among that hate environment, the Americans would like to place their nuclear weapons, their hydrogen bombs, their attack-oriented weaponry to destroy the Russian Federation. That's the real story of what's happening here. Mm-hmm. And that's why the Russian army is moving so slowly. That's why the Russian army is trying everything it can to avoid civilian casualties and to minimize the number of Ukrainians who are killed. Basically, the Ukrainians who are being killed in this war are the fanatical neo-Nazis and the men under their command who are being driven from behind by their officers with guns at their backs to die on the tank traps and the barbed wire that Russia has put up to defend the civilian population of ethnic Russians in Ukraine.
I see. Now, Scott, let's talk about peace. Now, Saudi Arabia, as you may know, has hosted this peace conference on the Ukraine war. There were representatives from around 40 countries like Brazil, the UK, India, China, the US, Turkey, South Africa. Also, some EU countries were also in attendance. Everyone except Russia. So my first question is, why should Russia be excluded?
Well, I think Russia is aware that Saudi Arabia is doing this on its with the permission of Russia. Saudi Arabia isn't just doing this as a countermeasure to jeopardize its relationship or turn cold its warming opportunities with Russia. I think Saudi Arabia made full secret diplomatic connections with Russia and said, we would like to try and step in and see what we can cultivate with Ukraine. And Russia said, yes, go ahead. We're happy to do that. Russia isn't obsessive or narcissistic settling of this. They have their absolute values and requirements, and they're not going to budge on those because they've set their requirements as we need the following done in order to preserve our people, our culture, and this is an existential threat. No nuclear weapons in Ukraine, no biochemical weapons in Ukraine, no NATO membership in Ukraine, and no Nazi regime in Ukraine, period. End of story. Until that's done, we're going to have to chop down the grass until it's left is nothing but a desert oblivion. So Saudi Arabia stepping in, I think, is actually going to try and persuade Ukraine to adopt Russia's more than gracious offerings that they did last spring in order to preserve their life. But knowing the Ukrainian Zelensky U.S. puppet, the Biden administration, which your guest previously said is very right, the Americans don't care about a Ukrainian. They want to annihilate the entire country if they think it can hurt Russia in one small way. Well, that's the weak point, because Russia can advertise that in a soft war, propaganda, psychological war, and advertise to the entire population, the West is using you, brutalizing you, organ harvesting you, and destroying you for its own purposes. Come back and let brother and brother seek amends, seek a peaceful collaboration, and you need a third party to do that. Mm-hmm. Now, an interesting thing would be if Iran stepped in and added to this peace negotiation alongside Saudi Arabia, because Iran is very solidly, I think, on Russia's side. Russia knows that. And Saudi Arabia would be forced to soften any of its requirements if Iran was part of it. So this is a multipolar world, soft power diplomatic settlement that's in process. Okay.
Now, John, regarding this Saudi initiative, the press agency there has announced that mainly national security advisors were participating in the consultations, that Riyadh hopes would come up with peaceful ways to resolve the war in Ukraine. Do you expect this Saudi initiative to be a success, or is it going to be a non-starter?
Well, it's definitely not a non-starter. It's already started. I mean, that's point number one, and I think that I agree with he's exactly on the mark here, that there is no chance whatsoever that Saudi Arabia, after its warming of relations with Russia and after its contact with Iran recently, is going to start trying unilaterally to intervene in this affair. So Russia is definitely has already set the line in the sand that the ethnic Russian population of Ukraine is not going back to Ukraine. They have been annexed. They are a part proper of Russia, and that is non-negotiable. So by allowing Saudi Arabia to begin some preliminary pre-negotiations, Saudi Arabia can deliver that very message, that under no circumstances is there any chance whatsoever of the annexed territory of Russia being returned to Ukraine as some sort of a gift, as it was given in the past. Mm-hmm. We know that Crimea was gifted to Ukraine. That kind of mistake, that kind of naivete, has been shattered by the neo-Nazis in Ukraine, by Zelensky's puppet operation under U.S. control, and by the gung-ho attitude of NATO, who just wants another war to drive their economies, which are all failing. Those are all non-starters. Mm-hmm. Saudi Arabia is delivering the message. And I do agree with your other guest that this is an opportunity for Iran, which has excellent ties with Russia, which has excellent ties with China, to also join in bringing the stubborn, close-minded, and extremist Ukrainians to the peace table. Because they're either going to get bombed there or they're going to get convinced to go there.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay. Now, Scott, speaking of peace, let's look at the two conflicting sides. Demands Zelensky, for instance, proposed a 10-clause peace plan in November 2022. It includes mutual exchange of prisoners, ensuring nuclear, food, and energy security, withdrawal of all Russian forces from Ukraine, and the restoration of the complete territorial integrity of his country. Your assessment of the plan, is it logical and feasible?
No, it's fanatical, it's delusional, it's emotionally schizophrenic, and that's exactly what the West, American specific, has become. And your other guest has said it well. Not one inch of Russian territory is going to be returned to Ukraine because we've seen Ukrainians do to the Eastern Ukrainians, the Russians. They torture them. They organ harvest them. They do horrific acts of torture, crimes against humanity. They're taught to do this by the Mossad. They're taught to do this by the CIA. They're given drugs by the U.S., methamphetamines and ecstasy and things that animate them into zombie-like soldiers. That's a reality. So no part of Ukraine is going to be returned to Russia. And why should they? Because Russia's already been lied to by the Minsk agreements, by Germany, by France. So there's nothing the U.S. or Germany or France or NATO can say to Russia that can be relied upon. And I think Russia also recognizes that NATO as a whole is a paper tiger. It has 600 tanks. Russia has 900. Russia has hypersonic missiles. It has nuclear torpedoes that'll travel around the world. It has far superior technology and weapons than the West have because they make weapons to defend their people and their culture. The West makes weapons to enrich the military-industrial complex. And I think you're witnessing also a very dangerous situation that may develop as a false flag, where Joe Biden, the zombified American president, who's a coup d'etat against President Trump, Joe Biden most likely is going to allow a black flag, false flag event in Zaporizhzhia, the nuclear plant, or somewhere else, perhaps in the United States, and blame Russia for that. Mm-hmm. In order to try and initiate a draft and larger war,
okay.
But I think
of course,
it'll fail.
IAEA chief was there, and he spoke of existence of no explosive in that infrastructure. Anyway, now, John, talking of peace, President Zelensky is also calling for security guarantees for Ukraine and the creation of an international mechanism to compensate for his country's financial losses, and that by using Russian assets. Your take?
Absurd. The war started in 2014. That's point number one. That was when the United States admittedly, at their own admission, said that they spent $5 billion, that's just the publicly released data, to stage a coup d'etat to illegally, by force of violence, overthrow the legally elected president of Ukraine. In so doing, they kicked off a war that was running for 8 full years before Russia even entered the war. Then Russia tried to protect the people who were being subjected to genocide. And let me tell you, genocide is nothing new for the Ukrainians. The Ukrainians killed 200,000 Jews after World War I. Then they killed 250,000 Poles between the two wars. Ukrainians have been committing genocide since before the word genocide was invented. This is a nation which has been misled and which has been deceived into thinking that they have nothing to do with Russia, their closest blood brothers. They are victims of their colonizers. They are victims of the West, and they are victims of the American military-industrial complex that has a bunch of garbage weapons that they need to have destroyed. And I can tell you one thing, Russia is going to destroy those weapons. And when those weapons are destroyed, the U.S. taxpayer is going to see a bill in the trillions to replace them, because that's the only thing driving the U.S. economy. So Russia and Ukraine are at war now because the United States does not know how to make money anymore. They can't compete with China. They can't compete militarily with Russia. So they send the Ukrainians to die en masse to fill their pockets full of blood money. That's what's happening here. And anybody who says differently is either being paid by the United States or simply has an extremely low IQ.
Okay. Now, Scott, let's look at the other side. We talked about Zelensky's demands. Now, on the other side, we have Russian President Putin saying in this recent meeting where he got together African leaders in St. Petersburg, talking about grain deal and all that, that his country is ready for dialogue. As long as Ukraine is fighting, Russia cannot sit idle by and watch. They have to fight. That's what Putin said. But he said that he is there for dialogue if, for instance, Africa or China does the mediation. So given all what we've said so far, Zelensky's conditions and the war and all that's going on, what's the prospect of peace?
Well, the peace will come when Russia has annihilated Zelensky, either in his mansion in Florida or in Kiev or wherever he may be, along with his Nazi fanatics. That's when Russia will establish peace. They cannot establish peace where Zelensky remains alive or his regime remains in power, because then that cancer will grow as it did in the Minsk agreement. So Russia is going to be annihilating this echelon of leadership, and to try and do a cleansing of the leprosy and the gangrene that has infected the body politic of Ukraine. And I think the diplomatic efforts of Africa, of Saudi Arabia, hopefully of Iran, since Iranians, the Persians are far more intelligent when it comes to these sort of historical diplomatic engagements than many of the rest of the world. They're an ancient culture. And I think Iran could step in and do some magnificent diplomatic overtures to Zelensky and the regime to say, pack up your bags and leave, and you'll be alive. Don't do it, and you'll be dead, as will your entire progeny. So there won't be any peace until Russia decides that the conditions warrant peace. Because, again, remember, Russia sees this, and the world begins to see this as a existential battle for the world. If Ukraine falls to the U.S. Imperialism, then they will use that as a platform to attack Russia. Right. When Russia goes into breakup, then they'll attack Iran and China. So the world has to stand against this hegemonic empire.
Now, John, the West support is going on despite their own issues on home turf. Is it really worth all the trouble? And when it comes to the U.S., does the U.S. really want peace, or it wants the war to go on? How much longer is it going to help Kiev with ammo and military hardware, despite all the issues it has back home?
In the United States, it's no longer possible to refer to God. If you mention God, you're violating the Constitution. Yet it still says, "In God we trust," on their dollar bill. And that is their God. Mammon is the God of the United States. They do not care how many people die. They do not even care how many Americans die. They sent thousands and thousands of hundreds of thousands of Americans into Vietnam. 55,000 Americans died there with no result, except for the fact that the military-industrial complex had a war for 15 years in which everything they could make was being sold, and everybody who could work for them was making a salary, and the owners of the military-industrial complex and the banksters who run the U.S. political system, who buy the candidates, right, who set the agenda, were making themselves richer and richer. Mm-hmm. That's what America wants. The idea that America is doing anything today out of altruism, out of idealism, is so passé that I'd have to ask if the person is in a sleeping chamber from 100 years ago. There is no idea in Washington about doing something good for Ukraine. What okay. they're doing is they're attacking Russia and using the Ukrainian people as a bloody battering ram.
All right. Scott, there are some analyst observers, many of them, calling this a war of attrition that would not end as long as the West keeps pouring in weaponry into Ukraine. Your opinion on that? We have only 1 minute left.
Well, the weaponry will be basically unmanned because all the Ukrainians are going to be dead or shattered and unable to manage it, or they will be refusing to pick up and use those arms. That's the level this is approaching, the complete disintegration and disintegration of the Ukrainian army. Now, many of these weapons are going to end up along the Mexican border, and the cartel drug clans are going to be using those against the American southern border of Texas, California, Arizona, and New Mexico. That's the new flashpoint that many in the military are looking at as a result of this war. And you'll see also those weapons be used in Europe as the European, governments begin to encounter more and more disruptions and revolutionary protests.
Okay, unfortunately, that's all the time we have. Thank you so much, John Bostich in Belgrade, Scott Bennett in San Francisco.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
An-Naqi means the pure, the immaculate, the clean. Al-Hadi means the guide. All the Imams came for guidance.
As-salamu alaykum ya ahla bayt al-nubuwa wa mawdha' al-risala wa mukhtalaf al-malaik.
Peace be upon the directors of right guidance, the lanterns in darkness, the patterns of piety.
This is Dialogue,
an introduction into the most important dialogues and conversations of Imam Ali ibn Muhammad al-Hadi alayhi salam. Imam Ali ibn Muhammad al-Hadi alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, and he was the 10th divinely appointed Imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the 9th divinely appointed Imam, Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam. Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam was a pure branch from the tree of Nubuwwah, the tree of prophethood, and he was a brilliantly shining bow from the tree of Imama. It was by Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam and his fathers that the Almighty Allah has consolidated Islam and exalted monotheism.